Please state your name, current position, and field of study.
Okay, my name is Louise Proctor. I am the director of the Lunar and Planetary Institute down in Houston, Texas. My primary field of study is icy satellites. I spend a lot of my time on robotic space missions for NASA.
Very cool. What first sparked your interest in science, and then what led you to your field?
It's a bit of a long story. This is actually my second career. I was always interested in science as a kid. My parents would always take us to museums and art galleries and, you know, botanical gardens and things like that, because we lived in London, so we had a lot of places we could go, and they didn't cost anything, which was a good thing. And I, you know, they would teach me the constellations when we went camping, things like that. So I always had an interest in science. My dad's an engineer, was an engineer. My mom used to teach biology, among other things. When I was in school, wasn't quite so encouraged at school at that time, you know, as girls usually weren't. It wasn't really a very ladylike thing to do. So I got away from science, left school when I was 17, got into a bunch of sort of sales and marketing jobs that I'm not sure I was particularly great at, and then started taking a class in the evenings with the Open University when I was in my mid-20s in the UK, and that's a fantastic organization that basically anyone can go and get a degree if you're dedicated enough. So I started doing a Science Foundation course, came across things I'd never done at school, like earth science and, you know, really exciting things, and loved it so much that 2 years later I went to university to do my undergrad degree at the age of 27. So that's kind of, you know, it was a long, circuitous journey, but I did finally sort of get to, I think, where I was supposed to be all along, frankly.
And what's been your favorite part of this new career that you've carved out in science?
Oh, wow. Well, I mean, I get to work on space missions, which is really incredible. Lots of ups and downs. One of the most amazing things is when you see, I'm an imaging scientist, so sometimes I've been in a situation where I've seen an image come down from a spacecraft, you know, and we'd be like the first people ever to see the surface of that body. It doesn't get much better than that. It's pretty amazing feeling. So that's been great. And also just some of the discoveries along the way, and the idea that we're really exploring the solar system. You know, this is like Lewis and Clark, all those great explorers, Christopher Columbus, but we're out there doing it in the solar system sort of as we speak. So it's a pretty great time to be in science.
That has to be such an amazing feeling to be the first person to see something as it comes through from
It really is. And in a couple of my positions, I've worked on the camera team, or in one case, I worked on the messenger mission to Mercury. I always, you know, I've told this story before, but it's very pertinent, I think, that I was responsible for overseeing the targeting of Mercury. And so Mariner 10 had flown by Mercury 30 years before messenger got there. And we were looking at the side of Mercury that had never been seen by a spacecraft. So it was a huge and exciting time. And during the first flyby, there was some anomaly going on, I think, that the deep space network, instead of taking the data from Messenger, it had to go look for some other spacecraft that was in trouble. And so we were waiting and waiting and waiting for our data to come down. And I remember being in the room with my colleagues. You know, we'd just been, I think it was early evening at that point, all very excited and just waiting for these data to arrive. And we were standing around a terminal, and the first image of the unseen hemisphere of Mercury popped onto the screen. And my first thought was, oh, thank God it's in the middle of the frame, because I had targeted it. And then I thought, and how beautiful is that? So I'm getting emotional just talking about it. It's pretty amazing.
Was that your proudest moment?
That was definitely one of my proudest moments. I mean, that's a team. Obviously, it's a team effort. You know, it wasn't like just me going off and targeting on my own. But that we had worked for many years. You know, when you do these missions, they can take decades to come to fruition. So I think that was perhaps my proudest spacecraft moment. Just that it was all finally coming together. All those years of, you know, helping the engineers figure out how to build the instrument to do the science, planning the science, you know, launching. You know, there's so many things that can go wrong on a space mission. And everything has to be exactly right. And they're so expensive. And they're, you know, decades sometimes, certainly years of your life if something goes wrong. So when it all comes off and you get these incredible data sets and then you do incredible science, we learn so much about Mercury from that mission. It's pretty amazing.
I can only imagine what it feels like to work on something that's so expensive and be nervous about the outcome. Oh, yeah. When I interned at the Florida Aquarium, one of the exhibits that I helped care for was the leafy sea dragon, and each one was $5,000. And my boss was very particular about how they had to be fed. You had to throw a ghost shrimp in. You had to anticipate which way it would turn, not hit it in the head. And I was so nervous working with them because I was afraid I would do something to kill one and, you know, be held financially responsible, which I was assured I would not be. But it was nerve-wracking.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, it's a very risky business. And that's one reason why these missions cost so much. So as I've gone through my career, you know, I started out as a postdoc. Actually, in grad school, I worked on the Galileo mission, then worked as a postdoc on the NEAR mission to the asteroid Eros. It was my first job out of grad school. Then went to MESSENGER, and I sort of slowly worked my way forward. So at this point, I am currently the PI of a discovery mission proposal that we are hoping to put in to the next call in May or June. So at that point, now, I am really the responsible person. I mean, obviously, I have this fantastic team at JPL, but ultimately, the PI calls the shots. So I have to make the right decisions. And if I make the wrong decisions, $500 million of money that isn't being spent in the way that it should be. So, you know, we have to be careful stewards of taxpayers' money, because ultimately, we serve the public. You know, we're doing this for the benefit of humankind, not just to serve our own favorite, you know, scientific interest, although certainly there is an aspect of that as well.
And what's been the biggest challenge of your work?
That's a good question. It's quite intense. Sometimes you're working with data sets that aren't what you really would like. And I chose, you know, my thesis was on icy satellites, so primarily Ganymede and Europa, so large moons of Jupiter. And I have been working for the last probably nearly 15 years to try and get a Europa mission off the ground. And we finally, 3 or 4 years ago, got the go-ahead from NASA, and that's now in implementation. But that was such a long haul, you know. So having seen this incredible body with Galileo and having a limited data set, because the Galileo antenna didn't open properly, and we sort of, it did drop a probe off into Jupiter that was very successful, but the Galileo spacecraft itself, you know, we probably got something like, I've heard it estimated, 10% of the data return we should have had from the Jovian system. So we're dealing with data sets that are very sort of limited, and it always feels like the most interesting thing is right on the edge of your image or whatever you're looking at. But then to work over and over again, you know, a small but very dedicated group of people to try and get the next mission back to Europa. Europa is such an incredible, special place. Europa particularly because it has, we think, a salt water ocean beneath its icy shell that's probably, you know, three times as much water as the Earth's oceans, and yet it's a much smaller body. But it has all the ingredients we think are necessary for life. And as a geologist, it's just a really fascinating surface. But to keep doing these studies and going to talk to Congress and, you know, talking to NASA and working with our planetary decadal survey, which kind of charts the course of planetary, to try and get back to Europa, you know, and knowing that, I mean, right now, finally, it looks like we're really going to do it. But I could have gone my whole career without ever having gone back to the body that, you know, most, I find personally most fascinating. So, you know, it's just tough, I think, trying to get funding and trying to sometimes stay motivated. You know, you can get knocked back a lot, certainly in my field. So you've got to be tenacious.
It's good advice for anyone.
I think so.
What are the developments in your field, looking backwards, mm-hmm. that you think are the most significant and exciting? And then looking ahead, what are you most looking forward to?
Oh, developments in my field. So when you say my field, do you mean sort of like spacecraft mission work or just more the science kind of developments?
I mean, they're sort of related to me.
Okay, so I think since I started out, you know, there have been some great strides by NASA to come up with more efficient power sources, miniaturizing technology, things like that. So we can actually now take chemistry instruments with us to another planet, you know, and do really good science there. Obviously, the holy grail for most planetary scientists is having, especially chemists, but having a sample and bringing that back. And we're starting to do that now. So with planetary science, you know, the sort of canonical, I guess, exploration methods are that you fly by, you orbit, you land, you rove, and then you do sample return. And so with Mars, we're now getting to the last portion of that where we're going to do sample return. With somewhere like Europa, so far we haven't even been into orbit around it. We've flown by it at various times. With Galileo, it did multiple flybys, and even the new Europa mission will do multiple flybys because it's very, very hard to survive with that radiation environment. But I think there have been a lot of real fundamental leaps forward in understanding, like the radiation environment of Europa is a great one, but also technology development, things like solar panels. We didn't think solar panels could work out at the Jupiter system, and now the technology has come along far enough that we can now do a solar-powered mission there, which is great. We just restarted plutonium production. That will allow us to go out even further into the solar system because you know the sun just isn't strong enough out there, and so far the solar power technology, you know, doesn't quite make it out there either. So I think that there have just been some really good sort of increases in things like telecommunication and, you know, all of these kind of subsystems that enable us to get more data and go and explore the outer solar system. You know, we're about to fly by a Kuiper Belt object with New Horizons for the first time. You know, who would have thought that would be possible? So I think those kinds of developments are really important looking forward.
It's really incredible to think about all that's been achieved so far, and then, you know, fathom if AGU were to do this again in, mm-hmm. you know, 200 oh, years, yes. What's happened in the time since?
Well, I hope that by then we'll definitely be living on the moon. I think maybe we'll have some small outpost on Mars. And we will probably have robotic spacecraft on the surface of every planet in the solar system. And I am including Pluto in that. So I think we will have done things like seismology experiments. You know, we'll actually know what the interior structure of these bodies looks like. And maybe we'll be, you know, putting telescopes further out or roving around, you know, analyzing materials. I mean, some of these places, the surface of Europa, for example, you would not survive very long as a human. You know, it's just really unlikely. But robots are going to get more sophisticated. And so I think we really will be doing a lot of exploration while, you know, from the comfort of our couches, maybe through virtual reality, probably. I expect this conversation won't be happening in 100 years because we would be doing it remotely.
Probably.
You know, we wouldn't be in the same room.
Maybe there would be like holograms even.
Maybe.
So it would be like we're in the same room.
Or we'd be in the same room on the moon, maybe. That would be pretty cool. We'd be floating around in this
room.
That
would be great. I wish I could conduct virtual interviews on the moon.
On the moon, yeah.
Is there anything else that you would like to share or one message you would like to leave people with about you or your science?
The one thing about planetary science that is particularly pertinent as we celebrate 50 years of Apollo 11 landing on the moon is that it really wasn't until Apollo 8 looked back at the Earth, that we, I think, really began to appreciate the fragility of our Earth and the beauty of it. And as someone who studies different planets and bodies in the solar system, the Earth is a very special and unique place. And I really worry that we're not taking care of it the way we should. So I'd like to hope that as we move forward, certainly the political will in the US will join that of most of the rest of the world regarding the urgency of dealing with climate change. We do not want to be Venus.
Mm-hmm.
So I will leave you with that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.